You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson, you can see his musings, his mystified meanderings around the world of film at filmology.com, though. That is spelt with a PH. Josh, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Films that go against type, films that defy their own genre, perhaps, or maybe just the sort of film that really... It wasn't what it was advertised to be. It wasn't like it was in the trailer, or it wasn't like it was on the poster. We've got two films to talk about to kick off our discussion. One is new to the cinema, A Most Violent Year, which Josh is going to tell you about. The second is A Most Wanted Man, which is new to, well, actually, it's not that new. It's been around for a while. Going to talk about it mainly because I've just seen it, but also because it was Philip Seymour Hoffman's last leading man role. They are both, shall we say, against genre. So the film you're... If you've got a nomination for a film that really goes against type, 1300 222 774. And we are going to play the trailers from these films as a way of giving you the idea that they're not quite what they were advertised to be. Josh, give us the setup first for A Most Violent Year, just enough so we can make sense of the trailer.
Okay, so A Most Violent Year is a film from director J.C. Chandor, who we talked about last year when we looked at that Robert Redford On a Boat film, All Is Lost. It's set in New York City, 1981. We have Oscar Isaacs, who's playing an oil businessman by the name of Abel Morales. It's the immigrant experience, early 80s New York. And where this is, I guess, a genre-defying film, it's a kind of a gangster film. It already sounds a bit like a Scorsese or a Francis Ford Coppola film. But the difference is he wants to go legit. He's not part of the mob. He's trying to carve out his business in a legitimate manner. He's trying to avoid violence at all costs. And his wife, played by Jessica Chastain, she's the violent one. She's the, we've got to take him to the mattresses type of woman. Okay. So it's already playing with those tropes of the sort of the noir gangster, you know, type film. And this is what I think makes this film interesting. It's committed to a gangster type genre piece in many ways, but it certainly borrows and alters a number of those tropes.
Okay, let's have a little listen to the trailer for A Most Violent Year.
I understand you and your men have a job to do here, but we're in the middle of a 10-year-old's birthday party.
I'm sorry, but we are coming in.
That's not a problem. We have nothing to hide from you. My husband is a good man. Don't mistake his honesty for weakness. He deserves respect. This was very disrespectful.
I run a fair and clean business, and I will fight till my last breath to prove that.
These are dangerous times, and we have to adapt. It's not like when we was driving.
Okay, so I've got to confess, Josh, I saw this trailer in the prelude to another film, and I didn't really understand what it was about. The trailer's actually confusing.
Right. Well, I don't think I'd seen the trailer before seeing the film. Or maybe I hadn't just assumed it was a gangster film. I mean, it's called A Most Violent Year, even though, and maybe this is where the whole sort of genre-defying aspect starts, it doesn't cover a year. It only covers 33 days. And, you know, it's not particularly violent. That's one of the key aspects of this film. You know, it's an interesting film, and it's I realised Chandor was doing something quite different very early on, because this is a slow burn film. This is a measured pace film. This is really the director's traits. I mean, that was the sort of the hallmark of All Is Lost and his earlier film, Margin Call, which was one of those global financial crisis type films. When we talked about this last week, and here it comes up again, this idea of film which starts to reflect, or it seems more in tune tonally at least, with the types of television, like the glossy HBO-type cable network television that we're seeing now. And this feels very much in that vein, very polished. The look of this film captures...
Beautiful period piece.
Look, it's stunning. And it doesn't look like a New York film that's shot on a Hollywood soundstage. I mean, it looks gritty. One of the opening shots of this film is Oscar Isaacs. He's running through the dilapidated back streets of kind of the Dockland areas of New York, which is actually shot in Detroit, because now it's so dilapidated that it stands in for New York in the 80s. But it has that sort of gritty authenticity. I should have mentioned, we heard him briefly there, Albert Brooks makes a cameo as Oscar Isaac's lawyer in this.
I say it here and it comes out there. I can't get that line out of my mind when I hear Albert Brooks, but still.
And actually David Oyelowo pops up again. And strangely enough, this film and Selma were both shot by the same cinematographer. So there's all these connections to last week. But yeah, I found this film really interesting, because once I got in tune with it tonally, and once it sort of stuck to its guns, it's a probably poor choice of words given the film doesn't want to indulge this violence violence. I thought that was something interesting that the film was doing. It wasn't indulging almost an audience desire when you go to see a gangster film.
It's advertised as that.
It really is. I mean, the fact that it's called a most violent year, you know, you automatically assume that's what it's going to be like. But one of the key tensions and what I think where the film actually is still interesting, despite the fact it doesn't sort of pander to the violence, is the relationship between Oscar Isaacs and his wife, because in this case, she's not the typical femme fatale who's the kind of gangster's mole. She's the domesticated housewife, but she's the one who's pro-gun. It's her father that used to be in the mob that we get the sense that, you know, he's kind of got in on the ground floor with the mob, but now he's trying to go legit. In many ways, this is the film that Godfather 3 should have been.
Right,
you know, the whole thing of Godfather 3 is Corleone's finally saying, you know what, after all these years of bloodshed, now I want to be legit. And of course, it doesn't pan out that way, and the film was,
and it doesn't work.
Doesn't work either. But here it does kind of work almost to the last sort of few moments of the film, where it almost kind of wants to give a bit of ground in terms of that violence. But I'm willing to forgive it, because I thought it was just such a well-acted, clever, beautiful looking film and sounding film too. I mean, we heard some Marvin Gaye there in the trailer, which I think is from the opening scene. Yeah, this is a really smart film, and I think that question we've been talking about.
Without a trace though, isn't it? I mean, I've seen the odd review.
Yeah, but... well, possibly. I mean, but that question you posed again last week, and I've been thinking about it all week, is there a place for these types of films in cinema? And I have to say yes. I think I don't want to...
This is different, isn't it? Because it's got some core emotional truth. I mean, even the idea going legit, okay, what emotional character, whatever, you know, physical fight against whoever do you need to go through? That's different. You can paint a picture, you can have a small vignette of life, and even with A Most Wanted Man, it's essentially about one essential problem. Feature films, though, have a real difficulty with the very things that they're focusing on. So, Imitation Game, Theory of Everything, Selma, American Sniper. Because we know so much about a true story, a real story, they can't compete with what we know. And in my mind, you inevitably compare them to the great character build of a 3, 4, 5 season TV series. So it sounds like A Most Violent Year, that's different. You're trying to tell a simpler story. I can't access that story anywhere else. Therefore, the limited frame of the film isn't frustrating.
But it's also structural and tonal, and that's where I think it has the clearest link back to contemporary television, because it takes a lot of confidence for a director, and maybe even for a studio and the distributors and exhibitors, to show a film that has extended scenes of characters talking. I mean, this is not something that we're used to now. The generic mold for Hollywood studio commercial-driven films are short scenes, you know, intercut
3 seconds per edit.
Yeah, three-second conversation scenes with 8-minute action sequences. You know, P.T. Anderson has a retrospective on at the moment, and he's got a film that comes out next week, and I've been listening to a lot of his interviews during the week. And that's one of the things he keeps saying about his films. You know, filmmakers have almost forgotten the art of conversation in cinema. They've forgotten the art of character-driven drama because the industry has predominantly moved away from that. And that's why I think this film, in some ways, is a kind of a, you know, a throwback to the 70s style of filmmaking, but also it reaffirms the need for these types of films, that there is a place for this.
And maybe that also comes from all the premium TV shows. There's a lot of extended scenes of people talking on TV, so now the industry is going, oh, okay, there actually is an audience for people who can stand a 5-minute or 3-minute conversation.
And maybe that's where the marketing needs to catch up, because I think the marketing for this film perhaps gave an impression that this was actually not like those shows, and they're still trying to market it as a very different type of genre, as a traditional commercial gangster film, which automatically puts the audience offside, because 5 minutes in, they're going, hang on, where's the guns? What do you mean? Our lead character's against violence? What's, you know?
Like Birdman trailer,
like Foxcatcher, perhaps, you know, like Calvary, we talked about last year. It's a film that makes it look like a black comedy, and it's quite a serious film, you know.
Okay, Josh Nelson is with me. That film is A Most Violent Year. I'd love to know your nominations for, I guess, genre-defying the movie that gave you the complete opposite to what you were promised, either in the advertising or the trailer. Great text here. 1300-222-774 is the phone number. This text says, Fight Club. The advertising make it look like a boring, blokey fistfight film. It didn't let on at all how deeply the film picks apart our modern existence. I don't even remember the trailer, but still. And Jane in Collingwood pointing out that A Most Violent Year, written by the Aussie playwright and screenwriter Andrew Bovell.
A Most Wanted Man.
Sorry, A Most Wanted Man. Yep. Oh, sorry, A Most Wanted Man is... I'm sorry. Was there not a... I thought there was an Australian involvement in A Most Violent Year, but now I'm confusing my...
It's easy to confuse when they're both A Most and A Most.
I didn't even pick up on that. Isn't that kind of...
So, Colin, if there's another film that starts with A Most, let us know.
That's very slow of me to not pick up on that at all. Getting some nice suggestions on text for, I guess, movies that defy the advertising. Kick-Ass, was suggested it was another superhero film, good for all the family. In reality, it had no superpowered characters, was rated R, and included such things as graphic knife fights and a 12-year-old character who drops the F-bomb on many occasions. Awesome film, but just not what most people were expecting. And you're quite entertaining as well with your texts that about these movies. Every science fiction film ever, suggests Christian, and I'll read this out because it's funny. 50 Shades of Grey, a porno that men have no interest in watching. That's from Morgan in Spotswood. I've no idea what the box office says. Another... I actually have no idea where to place this film in categories. A Most Wanted Man, as I mentioned, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Willem Dafoe, Robin Wright from House of Cards and The Princess Bride, etc. Based on the John le Carré book. Before we get to the trailer, Josh, just the simple setup, what the sort of the voices they're going to hear. Do you remember?
Oh, geez, it's been a while since I watched this. From memory, Philip Seymour Hoffman is trying to hunt down terrorists, and his approach to doing so is to nab kind of the smaller people. And, I mean, this is, okay, there's a line that's stuck with me ever since I watched this, and there's a line that he's using to justify his tactics in the war on terror, and that is, it takes a minnow to catch a barracuda to catch a shark. And this is this idea that you've got to start at the bottom and use bait and you kind of climb your way up. And he uses Rachel McAdams, who I think is a lawyer for one of them, and he weaves her into the web. And then what makes this film quite interesting is then we have the other intelligence agencies become involved. So like the CIA, who I think is represented by Robin Wright. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the curious thing, it's set in Hamburg. So it's all about, they're all supposed to have German accents, which they kind of do and then kind of don't. I'm not sure if that works or not. But have a listen to the trailer, because it sounds like a very traditional action spy film, or at least the trailer looked like that to me. Have a listen.
German intelligence needs a job to be done that German law won't let it do. Our unit was set up to develop resources.
We're not policemen.
We're spies. Our sources don't come to us.
Hi, Annabelle. Good to see you.
We find them. When they're ours, we direct them at bigger targets. It takes a minnow to catch a barracuda to catch a shark.
They're moving.
You can't do this. I'm a lawyer.
Lawyer? That social worker for terrorists. You've crossed the line. You're on their side now.
So, yeah, that strangely accented voice is Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, I mean, he's actually remarkable in this. He's huge, he's hulking, and, of course, you can't watch this and not think about the fact that he is now dead, of course. And he looks unhealthy. He looks like he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. I actually loved watching this film, but I wasn't actually sure that it worked because they're all really good actors. There's lots of great conversation. There is no real, there's one sort of chase scene that kind of comes close to your average James Bond or Bourne film. Did this work for you, this film?
It did in a probably an intellectual sense more than an entertainment sense of the word, because what really struck me about this film, and it's from director Anton Corbijn, who got his kind of start making films for video clips for New Order and Joy Division, I think,
really?
Back in the day. Yeah, in that kind of era, is there's an almost deliberate attempt to reduce the film to a monochrome level of drama. There's no real highs and lows. There's just this constant level of conversation and drama and tension and unease without trying to pander to action set pieces or chase sequences or, you know, whatever the typical traits of the spy genre might be, assassinations and so on. And I kind of like that. It was so committed to this, you know, this dramatic type of film, which was so antithetical to most spy films, that I appreciate it. Did it work on a dramatic level? Maybe not, but it actually is in tone with what the film, I think, is saying, which is the kind of helplessness of the intelligence community and the situation that they're trying to kind of work in. And that end, for me, really packed a punch. And maybe that's because you've kind of, it lulls you into this kind of, you know, like I said, monochrome level of drama. Yeah. And then at the end, it's like, oh, wow, I need a drink.
It's really depressing, isn't it? So, look, we won't mention the ending, but yes, it's got one of those kind of killer endings. But again, it really plays on... I actually felt like I was watching the edited sequence from an extended TV series, and it worked because I didn't need to know the whole story. I didn't need to know people's backstories. It felt and looked like a premium HBO TV show. I don't know if – maybe I watch TV and I don't see enough films. I don't know.
Potentially.
Yeah, maybe. Look, on suggestions – so that one is A Most Wanted Man, and it's just genuinely incredibly sad to watch Philip Seymour Hoffman, who can actually even carry off – What I don't think is a very good German accent.
I like it.
But it works. I mean, yeah. he's unbelievably magnetic. He makes every film. But on movies that are genre-defying, a text here, Master and Commander, advertised as a grand work of genius, was absolute indulgent graphics. Someone's saying No Country for Old Men wasn't what was advertised. Is that right? I don't remember what was that. That's
was certainly not your traditional Western, and maybe that's how they made it look. I can't remember the advertising for that film.
That's a wonderful film.
Yeah.
All that dialogue straight from the corner.
Yeah, that's the strength of the book. Oh, I mean, yeah, it's amazing.
Never ending story. Finished in 1.5 hours. I thought it would never end when I watched it as a child. That's funny. And someone else, like Chinatown. What's like Chinatown? But Chinatown's quite genre defying. They don't like, surely though, if they don't give you what they promise in the trailer, that's two things, isn't it? Either A, they're dressing it up. Well, they're dressing it up because they're terrified it'll bomb, or B, they're dressing it up because they know it stinks and they just want to at least try and get people in the door.
Well, the other problem is because Hollywood's so organised around genre filmmaking, if there's a film that can't be neatly categorised that's managed to get through the system to production, they will try and market it as a genre film to get bums on seats because that's what people, most people, I think, go to see.
Is the trailer what drives the audience? Do you know? They must look at that.
I think first and foremost, it's star power. I mean, that's what gets films made is, you know, genres help with a pitch when you're making a pitch to a studio or whoever it might be, but it's your film doesn't get made unless you've got a name attached to it. And most films get greenlit before they've got a script. Like if you get someone like Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise attached to a film, the film will go into production sometimes without a script.
And do you think there's a lot of people trying to do the high, low, low, high thing in Hollywood? Are they deliberately trying to, you know, come in with the art house sensibility on the action flick? I very much feel like that with the Bourne films, even though they've kind of become a cliche. When the second one came out, it was trying to, you know, bring some sort of, I don't know, European art house sensibility. They're sort of trying to take the high low, and sometimes now with the superhero films, they're trying to take the low when they can into some sort of, for lack of a better description, highfalutin direction.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, the best thing about the Marvel verse as it's unfolding at the moment is the second round of films were far more adventurous than the first round. The first one were pretty run-of-the-mill origin stories that didn't really kind of work, which we saw with Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, it was a big budget film, but because it didn't have the franchise tag, they could be quite playful, and it really paid off. So maybe, but it's always the problem with Hollywood, they fall back on what's safe. So who knows, the third round and the fourth round and the fifth round that we're going to get of all these franchises may fall back on trying to be safe and just, you know,
might feel like a sledgehammer to the head if we're lucky. Okay. A Most Wanted Man is DVD streaming, that sort of thing. A Most Violent Year is in which sort of cinemas?
Limited.
Limited, okay. But decent. Josh really enjoyed it. Josh, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.